Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the shooting of two police officers in Brooklyn, New York, that has exacerbated divisions in the city between minority residents and the police, and between the police and Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York, who was disrespected by the police who turned their backs on him at a press conference at the hospital where the slain policemen were pronounced dead. Aubrey Hendricks, a visiting scholar in religion and African American studies at Columbia University, joins us to discuss how the divide can be bridged politically and socially as attention turns from the rash of shootings of young black men by white police officers to the assassination of two police officers by an African American criminal claiming to be acting in the name of victims of police violence. Then we'll examine the repercussions of the slaughter of school children at an army school in Pakistan and how the incident is impacting the already volatile politics of Pakistan, where the army casts a long shadow over civilian government and where state-sponsored terrorism under a nuclear umbrella has been the country's foreign policy, which is now showing signs of backfiring. An expert on Pakistan, Chris Fair, a professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University and author of Fighting to the End, Pakistan's Way of War, joins us to discuss mixed signals coming out of Pakistan as the government cracks down on the Pakistan Taliban at the same time releasing from prison the architect of the Mumbai massacre. Then finally, we'll speak with William Leogrand, a Latin American specialist at American University and co-author of Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana, who is just back from Cuba, and will discuss the secret back channel that brought about the historic agreement between the United States and Cuba to end the over 50-year-long frozen Cold War relationship and begin to normalize diplomatic and economic relations between the Colossus of the North and the tiny island nation of Cuba, 90 miles from Florida. And joining us now is Aubrey Hendricks, a visiting scholar in religion and African-American studies at Columbia University and professor of biblical interpretation at the New York Theological Seminary. He has been called one of the greatest intellectuals and most exciting scholars in America today and is the author of The Politics of Jesus, Rediscovering the Truth, the True Revolutionary Nature of Jesus' Teaching and How They Have Been Corrupted. And his latest book is The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politic. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aubrey Hendricks.
Thank you. Always good to be with you, Brother Masters.
And I appreciate talking with you, Aubrey. It's not exactly the best circumstances, but you're living in a very divided city that was already divided along racial lines, particularly with minorities being suspicious of the police. But now you have a division between the police and the mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, who is married to an African American woman and has two children, and expressed some concern some time ago during the Ferguson demonstrations that he was concerned for his own teenage son going out on the streets. So what's the heart of the animus between the mayor and his police department?
Well, excuse me. You know, it really seems to me that police just do not want anyone to question their behavior or hold them accountable for their excesses, because the governor, the mayor has not attacked them. He's just talked about you know, doing what is just and making sure that all citizens are safe, including the police. So there's no reason for them to have any animus at all. You know, I mean, their animus, I guess, stems from the fact that they're called to account. They just want to, from my observation, they want to do whatever they want and don't want anyone to question them at all.
At the press conference at the hospital where the two officers were pronounced dead, the police turned their back on the mayor when he entered and gave the press conference, and it was a clear sign of disrespect. The head of the police union has been extremely critical of the mayor. But again, I don't see what their specific complaints are about this particular mayor and his actions towards the department.
That's a great observation. No, I can't really point to any thing that he has done wrong. Again, unless it comes down to a question of his questioning the actions of the police. I mean, he never attacked them at all. He's really talking about fairness and even-handedness and accountability. And they just don't, has been my observation for many years, they do not want to be held accountable like every other American citizen for their actions. And, you know, I think it's still cut from the same cloth as the amount of disrespect that the president gets, because he would dare to have, at least in their minds, to acknowledge the right of every American to be treated fairly. I mean, why turn your back on this man when he's saying that the people have a right to expect to be protected by those who are paid to protect them?
Again, I'm speaking with Aubrey Hendricks, who is a visiting scholar in religion and African American studies at Columbia University and professor of biblical interpretation at New York Theological Seminary. And his latest book is The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politic. So how would you, as a man of the cloth, Aubrey, deal with this situation? If you were asked to mediate between the police and the mayor?
Well, pardon me, I'm fighting a little bit of a cold. It would be sort of difficult because, I'll be honest with you, I don't have a lot of faith in the police. And in the lack of accountability sort of tips the scales. And so I'd have much more to say to the police than I would to the mayor. I think that the mayor, there's not a lot that the mayor could do very differently, and with regard to his relationship with the police. It still comes down, I mean, because they don't want any oversight. They don't want police civilian review boards. So it's not on the mayor. I mean, I'd have to speak directly to the police and say, look, you guys have to realize that you are not super citizens. You know, you do not have the right to kill. If you're the subject of a great deal of animus right now, it's because of your own actions and activity. And don't blame this deranged gunman for noticing unjust killings. I mean, blame yourself for privileging these unjust killings and not coming out and attacking them themselves. And people would react differently if somebody would come out and say, look, we don't support this. This is absolutely wrong. Eric Garner, his death was ruled a homicide, an official homicide, and we believe someone has to be held accountable. They're saying just the opposite. No, well, it's a homicide, but no one should be held accountable. And that's just not acceptable.
So speaking on ABC's This Week, former New York City Police Commissioner Ray Kelly said on Sunday that the antipathy between the mayor and the police goes back to what Mr. Kelly referred to as de Blasio's anti-cop platform. And the distrust, he said, was exacerbated when Mr. de Blasio spoke publicly about how he talked to his son Dante about the dangers he could face when dealing with the police. Again, it just, you just wonder, it feels like this is being made up out of a whole cloth. If you have an African-American son, it's your duty, isn't it, to explain to him that you've got to be careful because, and don't provoke the police. I mean, isn't that a reasonable thing to impart to your son?
It's very reasonable. I don't know how, obviously it wasn't particularly politic, because it, I guess one could see it as him setting up antipathy between the two sides. I guess if he committed a sin, it was that he was too honest. But But it's been long known for many years that we feel like targets. We black men of whatever age, and black women also. And he was just acknowledging what is well-known truth and has been for generations. But again, we didn't hear the police interrogate any of that statement. There was nothing like, well, maybe there is some truth to it, or maybe we could do something differently, or Mayor, why do you say that? What kinds of actions have made you come to that conclusion? None of that. Just stonewalling. We're right, you're wrong. How dare you call us to account for anything that we've done? And that's the way I see it, and that's the way that I think most of the black community sees it. And it's just not acceptable. And until the police start taking responsibility for their own actions and start being willing to be accountable to those for whom they are supposed to work, it's going to continue. It's not going to get any better. It's on the police to act differently, at least to talk differently, at least being willing to listen. They're not even willing to listen, to entertain any kind of discussion that they might be wrong in what they're doing.
Well, clearly this criminal who shot the police, who has a long criminal record, had already shot his girlfriend in Baltimore before moving to New York. He'd taken her Instagram account and was posting stuff that was incredibly inflammatory and should have been followed up on. I just don't know how you can, you know, whose job it is to monitor all social media. We had the same problem here recently in Santa Barbara, where a young man posted threats that he carried out and shot a number of students up at the university there. And this fellow apparently made his intentions clear, but he apparently comes out of a prison gang that's violently anti-police, etc. And unfortunately, it's, you know, the fact that he said he was doing this in the name of the victims of police violence, mm-hmm. of course, is, mm-hmm. I mean, this is, you know, this guy's a criminal. I mean, but unfortunately, yeah. It seems to be getting some traction. And I don't know who could speak up the loudest to sort of say, wait a minute, this guy's not speaking for anybody. He's a criminal.
Yeah, and the police are going to want to try to muffle those voices or override it as much as possible. But yes, I mean, he had a lot of, I mean, he was a nut maybe, but then again, maybe he just had a lot of antipathy because the police have arrested him for real criminal acts, but he was a criminal. And they're forgetting that, like you mentioned, he killed his girlfriend or his wife prior to coming. These were just psychotic acts, and the police happened to be on the wrong end of it, unfortunately. But, you know, you can't... They're using that to discredit all of the concerns of the protesters. And they're actually painting the peaceful protesters as killers when what they're protesting are police killings. I mean, it's sort of brilliant Machiavellian move. I mean, they're going to use this to paint as unrighteous every question of their behavior, and to paint themselves as the real victims. And they've, you know, they're making a full court press already. And what we're worried about here in New York and elsewhere is that the inevitable repression that we knew and pushback that we knew would be coming, we're worried that it's going to come much more quickly and much more violently and viciously as a result of this. I mean, these police in New York are very vicious. It seems like they use any excuse they can to justify their wilding out. And now they have all kinds of, in their mind, all kinds of reasons to just, you know, to just stretch, to strike out and make it act like it's a legitimate police activity to protect the peace. But they're going to shoot first, really shoot first, or strike first and ask questions later. Now that's clear, and it's going to be very dangerous, unfortunately. The police in New York have always been out of control, And with something like this, they really will be out of control. It's going to be, we have to watch ourselves.
Well, the police are saying that there's at least some that have been interviewed by the press say there's blood on the hands of City Hall in the office of the mayor. De Blasio doesn't seem to be able to defend himself against these attacks that don't seem to have any foundation except the fact that he advised his own African-American son to be careful on the streets. Is there anybody? I mean, Bratton is not supposed to. He's supposed to be in one of the sort of new generation of highly trained, intelligent police chiefs. Is there anybody that can talk to him? Or I mean, what's your sense of what the next step is? Because you've got a divided and volatile city there, and there's already enough tensions without. This thing being the straw that breaks the camel's back.
Yeah, I don't know. I think Bratton, even on his best day, is caught in a vice. He has to take the police side. But what he will not do, and what they're not doing, is looking at the blood that happened to be on police hands. I mean, the mayor has no blood on his hands. This whole thing started because blood on the police hands. And who can defend the mayor? I don't know who can defend the mayor. Anyone in the black community speaks up, of course, we've seen as they won't have much legitimacy with the police and their sympathizers because they'll just be seen as apologists. It would have to be Bratton, I think, who would have to stand up, or someone on the right-wing side, someone like Congressman King here in New York, though that probably won't happen with him. He's not the most reasonable man at all. But someone on their side will have to stand up and say, wait a minute, you know, what we had was a nut who was angry at police. He would have found some other excuse to kill police if this hadn't happened. And you can't and don't hold this against the whole community. But I don't know who's going to stand up and do that. I just any politician who stood up and do that would really hurt themselves, I guess, in their own eyes. The police.
Well, Aubrey Hendricks, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Brother Masters. All we can do is just work for the best, hope and pray for the best, and that justice will eventually really be done in this situation.
And again, I've been speaking with Aubrey Hendricks, who's a visiting scholar in religion and African American studies at Columbia University and professor of biblical interpretation at the New York Theological Seminary. He is the author of The Politics of Jesus, Rediscovering the True Revolutionary Nature of Jesus' Teaching and How They Have Been Corrupted. And his latest book is The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politic. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how the Pakistan government is cracking down on the Pakistan Taliban at the same time releasing the architect of the Mumbai massacre from prison. Are you really for peace? Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Christine Fair, who's a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan and a professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, The Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point, and her latest book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Oh, hey, thank you for having me.
And what's your sense of how this incident of the slaughter of the school children at the army school in Peshawar has had on the already volatile politics in Pakistan? There seems to have been an uptick in action on the part of the Pakistan military, but you've got the challenger to the Prime Minister, Imran Khan, who represents the areas where the slaughter took place. He, for the longest time, seems to have been overly sympathetic to the Taliban. So let's start with that. Has this discredited Imran Khan, this incident?
Well, I think there are several issues that probably need to be unpacked a little bit. First is that this is not the first slaughter of its type. In fact, just about a year ago, almost to date, there was a similar massacre of Christians in a church. No outrage. There have been massacres of upwards of 90 to 100 Ahmadis, as well as Shia in Pakistan. No outrage. What makes this different is that these attackers went in and killed a bunch of sons that were, not all of them, but many of whom were the sons of senior army personnel. So the first thing one has to realize is that Pakistanis are very selective about the deaths that they mourn. And so one of the problems in taking all of the outrage seriously is that Pakistanis are very willing to distinguish what kind of victims deserve sympathy and deserve action, and which ones don't. But the problem is the very same people that are killing the Shia and the Ahmadis and the Christians and even massacring Hindus, although I don't think there's been a massacre of this size, these are the same people that are involved in this school attack. So unless Pakistanis are willing to embrace a total social and cultural war against terrorism, irrespective of the victims, this problem isn't going to go away. Imran Khan is just one example of Pakistan's political class that selectively voices outrage depending on who the victims are. But he's not the only one, by any means. Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has, as one of his political allies, one of the groups that are involved in killing Shia. The ASWJ is its current nickname, but it's also a component of the Pakistani Taliban.
So there are some clearly mixed signals coming out of Pakistan where the government is cracking down on the Pakistan Taliban at the same time releasing from prison the architect of the Mumbai massacre. So explain that to us if you can.
Yeah, so the first thing that one really has to understand is what they are and aren't doing in this so-called crackdown on the Pakistani Taliban. So they announced this operation in North Waziristan 5 months in advance of the operation. 5 months. You heard that correctly. And what they were trying to do was to take parts of the organization and convince them to go to Afghanistan and kill Americans and our allies, and in particular, Afghans. Incidentally, Pakistanis don't seem all that upset when 100-plus Afghan children are killed by the Taliban. Then the other thing they were trying to do was convince elements of the Pakistani Taliban to go kill Indians in India. And that's connected to the shelling that took place earlier this fall because the Pakistan military uses shelling to insert those militants. After 5 months of inducements, what remained were those elements of the Pakistan Taliban that could not be resurrected as good Taliban, right? So these are the people that remain steadfastly committed to taking on the state, and that's who they're targeting. But they did so only after they convinced large parts of the organization to go kill us in Afghanistan as well as go kill Indians in India. All right, going to your second point about the mastermind of the November 2008 attacks, this speaks to this larger lie. I'm just going to call it a lie. The Pakistanis have been saying that they're not going to distinguish between good terrorists and bad terrorists. The problem is Pakistan considers a terrorist to be a person who kills Pakistanis. You're not a terrorist if you kill Americans or Afghans or our allies in Afghanistan, or if you kill Indians. And so Pakistan's policy of continuing to use what the army will call Mujahideen to prosecute its policies outside continues. And this is very boldly evidenced by the fact that Luxi, an anti-terrorism court in Islamabad, said that they would release him on bail. The bail comes out to about $5,000, which is nothing for the ISI, of course. They did go ahead, and they're going to detain him for a couple more months under threat to public safety. But the thing is, even from prison, Luxi was organizing attacks in India. He was meeting with his cadres, using the safe and secure logistical facilities of the jail, and he even had a luxury suite with extensive conjugal visits, during which he even fathered a child. So even his incarceration, it is little more than a joke.
Well, also, the leader of the Lashkar-e-Taiba, the group that Luxi belongs to, he spoke in Lahore recently, denying that the Taliban were behind the Peshawar school massacres, and claimed that India was behind the conspiracy.
Oh, so this is the other important thing that your listeners need to understand. If you look at all the signs that say death to the Taliban, those signs are in English. If you listen to Pakistan's Urdu media and Punjabi media, which, I mean, obviously Hafiz Saeed is a Punjabi, but when he addresses rallies, he mostly speaks in Urdu, the culprits are all Indian. And it's not just him. If you are watching Pakistan's television commentators, they're all saying it's India. President Musharraf himself said that India's intelligence agency, RAW, was behind us. So if we are going to take Pakistan at its word that it's taking terrorism seriously, we have to have some confidence that it has properly diagnosed the problem, and it refuses to do so. So from my point of view, I've seen these watershed events before, many times, in fact, before. An outrage will take place where everyone is galvanized against the Pakistani Taliban, and then very quickly the narrative begins to fragment. Oh, this wasn't the Pakistani Taliban. These were obviously outside agents. The attackers were circumcised, meaning they were Hindu. And the public opinion about this problem relaxes. And you go pretty much back to the status quo ex ante. So, you know, I'm pretty confident that this isn't the last massacre, because of the structural fundaments that spur these kinds of massacres cannot and will not be addressed by the Pakistani government, or for that matter, by Pakistan civil society, much of which isn't even very civil.
But meanwhile, since 2001, the United States has given the Pakistan Army about $20 billion. And now we're sort of trying to get out of Afghanistan, where for the longest time the Taliban there, the Afghan Taliban, are being harbored, trained, equipped, and sent across the border to kill Americans right under the nose of the Pakistanis, which, you know, raises questions of complicity in this peculiar kind of kabuki that's been going on, where our allies being perpetually established in the back. So there's just a couple of questions in closing here, Chris Fair, to try and see if there's any hope here. Could one, if the deal goes through with Iran, I know it's going to be for another few months, would it be possible that we could suddenly change the situation there and supply Afghanistan through the road from the Gulf, from the Indian Ocean all the way up to Herat, and just forget about Pakistan, and then just hand Pakistan over to China and let China take charge of this mess?
Well, so I've been advocating using Iran, actually, for years now, because not all of our NATO partners have issues with Iran. And let's be very blunt, there's nothing that Iran has done that Pakistan hasn't done more of, right? So the opponents to Iran will say, oh, it supports terrorism and wants to have a nuclear weapon. Well, I can't even take that seriously, right? Iran could only aspire to be Pakistan. Yet we've been able to throw $30 billion down Pakistan's throat, and what we've gotten for it is a bunch of dead American soldiers and dead Afghans. So there's no reason why there could not have been some sort of private sector use of Iran's port in Chabahar as well as in Bandar Abbas. But yeah, I think in principle, if we're going to stay in Afghanistan and we want to have any meaningful ability to put pressure on Pakistan, we need to be able to support ourselves without Pakistan. Now, we shouldn't be swapping one dependence upon one perfidious state for another, but Iran could conceivably, especially if the Indians were able to broker this, could be just one of the options that we have so that we don't have to be dependent upon Pakistan.
So what's your sense then of what's going on in Washington at a policy level? Because we've had this sort of, you know, autopilot type relationship where, it's not as bad as the Cuban one, but everybody's been in denial about the absurdity of it. And, if you watch this popular show on Showtime called Homeland, they don't pull their punches in terms of the movie or the TV series.
No, they seem to get it.
yeah. So something seems to be changing. At least people are being more open and honest about calling it the way it is.
I mean, that's true in parts of the U.S. government. So when I interact with people in DOD and the intelligence community, they are sick and tired of Pakistan. They just, sick and tired of the place. But where Pakistan still has a bunch of unforgivable apologists is in the State Department. And also, I may add in USAID. Neither the State Department nor USAID tire of explaining to Congress why it is we should continue wasting our money on a country that actually undermines almost all of our most important security interests in the region. And, of course, the reason why Pakistan still has this chorus of apologists is because of their nuclear weapons, right? They create this fear that if we don't continue to bend over and take it like a grown-up, the Islamist barbarians are going to be banging at the nuclear gate. And then we're going to be in some nuclear Armageddon. So their nuclear weapons not only extort India and persuade India to not pursue punitive approaches when Pakistan supports terrorism there, it's also nuclear weapons is how Pakistan continues to extort us for money and patronage.
So this is, meanwhile, all the while under their nuclear umbrella, they actively have a policy of state-sponsored terrorism.
Absolutely. And what I argue to the people that are afraid of the nuclear weapons falling in the hands of Islamists, I say to them, listen, all of your influence that you have sought to cultivate with your $30 billion hasn't brought us anything. And if, in fact, Pakistan is more dangerous than it was on September 10th, 2001, and it has proliferated those very nuclear weapons that it uses to blackmail us on our dime. So, if they're going to make a credible argument that we've been purchasing influence, I want to see some evidence of this influence. Because as far as I can see, Pakistan has expanded its nuclear arsenal. It's developing battlefield nuclear weapons. And has continued to remain committed to using Islamist terrorism as tools of policy. So what have we gotten for $30 billion? We got more terrorism. We got more nuclear weapons. How is that better for the American taxpayer? How is that better for American security interests? It's not.
Well, Christine Fair, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much again for having me.
And have a happy Christmas, by the way. Not the happiest conversation, but...
Have a happy Hanukkah Kwanzaa Festivus Eid Mass.
Well, thank you for covering all the bases. Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, who's a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan and a professor in security studies program at the at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan and Fortifying Pakistan, The Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point, and her latest book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the secret back channel between Washington and Havana. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William Leo Grant, who's a professor of government at American University and a specialist in Latin American politics and U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America. He's been a frequent advisor to government and private sector agencies and has written five books, including Our Own Backyard, The United States in Central America, 1977 to 1992. Most recently, he's the co-author of Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. Previously, he served on the staffs of the Democratic Policy Committee of the United States Senate and the Democratic Caucus Task Force on Central America of the United States House of Representatives. Professor Leo Grant has been a Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellow and a Pew Faculty Fellow in International Affairs. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Leo Grant.
My pleasure to be with you.
And you were in Cuba and you just got back, so you were there for the momentous announcement, the breakthrough after almost 50 years or 60 years of a frozen, dysfunctional relationship. What was the mood in Cuba?
The mood was really extraordinary. I was in an auditorium of people at a scholarly conference, and when the word came out simply that the two presidents were going to give simultaneous announcements, a huge round of applause went up from the audience. And then when we heard the details of the far-reaching scope of the announcement, particularly from President Obama, students spontaneously went out and marched down the street in celebration, and people hugged each other and cried. Even ordinary Cubans in the street, taxi drivers, the staff at the hotel, were just ecstatic. The feeling was as if a war had come to an end, and there was a sense of relief and also of hope that this would mean better economic relations between the two countries and therefore a faster-growing Cuban economy that would make people's lives better.
Well, since the announcement, Cuban President Raul Castro has gone on Cuban television and sort of, I guess, to some extent, tried to dampen enthusiasm by saying it's going to be a long and difficult struggle before the U.S. ends its economic embargo. And while talking about a new chapter, as President Obama had, he basically said that Cuba opening to the United States does not mean that Cuba is going to change its political system. We will demand respect of ours. So what's your sense of how, in other words, how the economics and politics playing out? That the assumption is, I guess, that the Cubans would like to keep, perhaps they're moving into more of a Chinese model where you can maintain, have economic openness, but at the same time maintaining political control. Is that the model that Raul Castro is implying here?
I think it is. There's no doubt that the Cubans have been talking extensively with economic experts from both Vietnam and China. And the direction that they've been moving with Raul Castro's economic reform program is very much toward a market socialism that looks like what Vietnam and China have done. I think in Raul's speech to the National Assembly, he was trying to dampen expectations because, in fact, the Cuban economy is not going to get dramatically better quickly as a result of the limited openings in trade that will stem from President Obama's announcement. There'll be more travel, so more tourists from the United States, and there'll be more trade because now exporters in the United States will be able to sell to private sector and private individuals in Cuba. But the Cuban private sector is still relatively small, and so this is not a panacea for the problems the Cuban economy faces. Raul Castro knows that, and I think he was trying to remind people of that in his speech.
Again, I'm speaking with William Neal Grand. He's a professor of government at American University and a specialist in Latin American politics and U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America. He's been a frequent advisor to government and private sector agencies and has written 5 books, the latest of which is Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana, and he's just back from Cuba. So, William Neal Grand, it seems like your book is right on the mark here, isn't it? There's been this particular back channel that delivered this deal. I understand that Obama's people have been talking with Raul Castro's people, what, for about a year and a half?
Well, I think the latest estimate I saw was about 13 months, but over a year in any event. And yes, it follows very much the pattern of some of the back channel negotiations that we wrote about in the book. It was kept very secret. Only a handful of people in the U.S. government were aware that it was going on until the very end to prevent a surge of domestic opposition from derailing it. I mean, we've already seen the really rabid response, frankly, from some conservative Republicans insulting the president over this decision, which the whole rest of the world is applauding, ironically. The Canadians were helpful by providing a venue, which they have done before in previous negotiations. The Vatican played a mediating role, and that's not the first time the Catholic Church has weighed in to try to help mediate relations. So it very much followed the pattern of what we've seen historically.
And what's your sense then of the of how the prisoner swap, what's its significance? Was that just a precursor or a precondition? You have to get that out of the way. Apparently the Pope played a useful role in that, and very little is known about the 53 other Cubans who were released, who the U.S. wanted, including, of course, the spy. He was a member of the Cuban intelligence service who spied against his own government and has been held for over 2 decades.
Yes, I think the cases, particularly of Alan Gross and the 3 remaining Cuban spies from the Cuban Five, those 2 cases really were an obstacle and had to be gotten out of the way before progress could be made on other issues. I think it was, frankly, clever of the Obama administration to trade the Cuban spies here in jail in the United States for the one CIA spy who was in jail in Cuba so that they could say it was spies for spies. And then the Cubans agreed, in addition to that, to simply release Alan Gross on humanitarian grounds. So there was no admission on the United States part that Alan Gross was a spy or had done anything improper. The release of the additional political prisoners in Cuba is a bonus, frankly, and the church back a couple of years ago was able to convince Raul Castro to release 127 political prisoners. So this is along the same lines of the Cubans trying to really move away from the past when people were arrested and sentenced to long sentences in prison for their political activity.
So, William Neal Grand, is it in any way a coincidence that the U.S. has just moved the House, the Senate, and the President about to sign sanctions against Venezuela. Oil prices are way down. Venezuela has a very polarized and turbulent politics, a lot of economic problems, tremendous amount of crime. And we know that essentially Chavez rescued his patron to some extent and his mentor, Fidel Castro, when the Russians pulled the plug on energy. And the subsidized energy has been an important prop, I think, to hold up the Cuban economy. The idea that Cuba may lose that subsidy, do you think that was in any way an impetus to make this deal?
Well, I think there's no question that the Cubans have been nervous about their dependency on Venezuelan oil for a number of years. And they've been trying to diversify their economic relations. And certainly trying to normalize relations with the United States is an important part of that. Cuba has potentially a lot to gain when the U.S. embargo is completely lifted. The Cubans are seeking $2 billion a year in foreign direct investment to try to boost the economy. Most of that could easily come from the United States. They're expanding their tourist sector, and the United States is an obvious market for them. So while I don't think that the current contemporary problems in Venezuela were an immediate impetus for this agreement, I think the sort of longer-term Cuban view of wanting to not be dependent certainly was a motivation.
So do you think, William Rio Grande, that this deal is going to be good for the Cuban people or just good for U.S. multinationals? There were reports I heard on a business program the other day. Some analyst was sort of gushing over the prospect of American companies setting up call centers in Cuba as opposed to Bombay or Bangladesh because you have a highly educated population in Cuba. And it's right in the hemisphere in the same time zone. And wouldn't this be wonderful if you got all these people that'll work for nothing? And this is a great opportunity. So it made me wonder whether who's going to benefit from this, the average Cuban or American companies tapping into a highly educated workforce that'll work very cheap?
Well, in fact, the Cuban workforce does not work that cheaply. And one of the deterrents to foreign investors going into Cuba as opposed to going into the Dominican Republic or Haiti has been that the state charges a pretty substantial price for their labor. So I think these reforms, though, really will make a big difference in the lives of ordinary Cubans. Tourism and travel to the island helps ordinary Cubans in multiple ways. Lots of tourists these days don't stay in the great big huge hotels. They rent a room from an ordinary Cuban family and stay with them. The tips that they give to people everywhere in the tourist sector go right into the pocket of ordinary people. The private restaurants that they go and eat at go into the hands of the private businessmen in Cuba and their staff. So in some ways, expanding travel and tourism puts money into the hands of ordinary Cubans faster than almost any other kind of economic activity. And the trade that Obama is going to allow now is trade with individual Cuban citizens. So if you want to put a new roof on your house and you can't get the material, you'll be able to buy it. You'll be able to get it from the United States and private businesses in Cuba. So the impact is going to be widespread in the Cuban economy and not just accruing to the government and large U.S. corporations.
Well, when you say, William Rio Grande, that Cubans don't work cheap, but the government mandates what they get paid, but does the government give that money back to the person or the worker, or does the government keep that money?
Now, what happened historically was that the government paid the Cuban worker working for a foreign enterprise the same rate of pay that a Cuban would get doing essentially the same job in a state enterprise, which was very low salary in real terms because it was in Cuban pesos, which are only worth a few cents in dollar terms. More recently, however, the government has begun to allow foreign companies to pay their Cuban labor force partly in hard currency. And so while the government has been taxing very severely the real value of those wages, it's taxing them less now in order to stimulate productivity on the part of the labor force and also to attract more foreign investment.
So the Cuban people are actually getting a little bit more money in their pocket. The government's not gouging them as much.
That's right. In the foreign sector, that's right.
Right. So what's your sense then of how this is going to play out in terms of the expectations versus the obstacles ahead? You know, you've got the Miami Cuban, particularly Rubio, the senator down there, screaming and carrying on. So is Menendez. I'm just wondering how much the Republicans who will be coming in soon, taking over the government, they've already showed enormous hostility and disdain to this president. They seem obsessed with just stitching him up in any way that they can, denying him any success. So I imagine they'll do what they can to sabotage this deal. Can they screw it up?
They are going to try. There's no question about it. Marco Rubio is on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, as is Robert Menendez, and between them, they will make it very tough for Obama to confirm his nominee to be ambassador to Cuba when we open normal relations. But that doesn't stop the president from establishing normal diplomatic relations with Cuba, even if we can't send an ambassador down there because the Senate won't approve it. The president can send his pick down there to serve as a chargé d'affaires. The other thing that Congress might try to do, of course, is use its appropriations power to prevent the president from spending any funds to implement his new policy. And they might also try to pass legislation that rolls back some of the changes that he's made in the existing sanctions regime. But, of course, they would have to first pass that legislation over a certain filibuster by Senate Democrats, and then they would have to pass it over a certain veto by the president himself. So while the Republicans can give the president a lot of headaches on this, I don't think they can stop the general change in direction and policy that he's set in motion.
And William Rio Grande, do you have any sense of what's going on with Cuban foreign policy? One of the hardliners from the Kremlin is visiting now in Cuba, Rogozin, and he's apparently, trying to get the Cubans to be more hostile to the United States and have a deeper military involvement with the Russians. At the same time, they're, Obama and Raul Castro are making this deal. So I'm just wondering. You know, we know that this has been a very star-crossed relationship. And in military terms, we almost had a nuclear war over Cuba. So, and Cuba, of course, during the Cold War, contributed troops, et cetera, in Angola. But it's never made any sense, this hostility, and nor has the embargo made any sense. And apparently enough adults in the room have persuaded President. I mean, every time the president goes to a multilateral forum in Latin America, he gets yelled at by everybody about, stopping this stupid thing that hasn't worked. Mm. So will there be a change in foreign policy, do you think?
Well, I think the Cubans are interested in having good relations with everyone. And, they had historically a very close relationship, obviously, with the Soviet Union. Putin is out to restore Russia's global influence and presence, and so he's visiting former allies like Cuba to try to repair relations. The Cubans, I'm sure, would be happy to have a commercial relationship with Russia, and particularly if Russia will grant them some trade credits. But the Cubans aren't stupid. They're not going to fall back into being a pawn between the United States and Russia. Cuban foreign policy has been extraordinarily active. They have, of course, been invited for the first time to the Summit of the Americas coming up next April in Panama. They were the chair of the Latin American community, the new Latin American community, CELAC, which excludes Canada and the United States. And they just hosted the CARICOM, the Caribbean Conference, just before this announcement. So they're very active as leaders in the region and in the Third World, and trying to have a good relationship with all of the major powers, from the European Union to China and Russia, and now the United States.
So just in closing, William Liagrand, there have been reports over the years, of course, that the U.S., because of this dysfunctional embargo, that only serves the interests of a small community in Florida, but, you know, acts against the broader U.S. interests. Obviously, it's an anachronism that finally looks like it may go away. But the argument has always been that in the meantime, you know, other countries like Spain and other European countries and Canada benefiting from relationships with economic ties with which they're generating with Cuba. Has the U.S. missed the boat? I mean, it sounds to me like with all these person-to-person relationships that if you, you know, took out the impediments, you've got an enormous active trade already going on between Miami Cubans and mainland Cubans, and that could explode, couldn't it?
Yes, I think there's no doubt about it. You know, when President Obama came into office, there were strict limits on the remittances that Cuban Americans could send, and the remittances were about $100 million a year. This year, they'll be over $2 billion a year. So the numbers have just skyrocketed, and that's a result of loosening up these government restrictions. But in terms of foreign investment, it's true the Canadians have gotten in there on the ground with mining, and particularly nickel, replacing U.S. companies that were there before 1959. And the Europeans have gotten in there and become the dominant players in the tourist and entertainment sector of the Cuban economy. But there's still a lot of opportunity in Cuba. And the Cuban government just recently released a list of well over 100 projects that they are seeking direct foreign investment for, including some deep water oil drilling off of their coast. So there's lots of opportunities if we can finally get rid of the remnants of the embargo.
Well, William Liagrand, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with William Liagrand, who's a professor of government at American University and a specialist in Latin American politics and U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America. He's been a frequent advisor to government and private sector agencies and has written five books, including Our Own Backyard, The United States in Central America, 1977 to 1992. Most recently, he's the co-author of Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana, and previously served on the staff to the Democratic Policy Committee of the United States Senate and the Democratic Caucus Task Force on Central America of the United States House of Representatives. Professor Liagrand has been a Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellow and a Pew Faculty Fellow in International Affairs. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Disappeared by hell.